Chapter 18. In the nasty little war between the CIA and the FBI, both sides often used certain journalists for tactical reasons. Preemptive strikes could be launched, counterattacks blunted, hasty retreats glossed over, even damage control could be implemented by manipulating the press. Dan Sandberg had cultivated sources on both sides for almost 20 years and was perfectly willing to be used when the information was correct and exclusive. He was also willing to assume the role of courier, cautiously moving between the armies with sensitive gossip to see how much the other side knew. In his effort to confirm the story that the FBI was investigating a cash for pardon scandal, he contacted his most reliable source at the CIA. He was met with the usual stonewall, one that lasted less than 48 hours. His contact at Langley was Rusty Lowell, a frazzled career man with shifting titles. Whatever he was paid to do, his real job was watching the press and advising Teddy Maynard on how to use and abuse it. He was not a snitch, not one to pass along anything that wasn't true. After years of working up the relationship, Sandberg was reasonably confident that most of what he got from Lowell was doled out by Teddy himself. They met at Tyson's Corner Mall over in Virginia, just off the Beltway, in the back of a cheap pizzeria on the upper-level food court. They each bought one slice of pepperoni and cheese and a soft drink, then found a booth where no one could see them. The usual rules applied. 1. Everything was off the record and deep background. 2. Lowell would give the green light before Sandberg could run any story. And 3. If anything Lowell said was contradicted by another source, he, Lowell, would have the chance to review it and offer the last word. As an investigative journalist, Sandberg hated the rules. However, Lowell had never been wrong, and he was not talking to anyone else. If Sandberg wanted to mine this rich source, he had to play by the rules.
"They found some money," Sandberg began, "and they think it's linked to a pardon."
Lowell's eyes always betrayed him because he was never deceitful. They narrowed immediately, and it was obvious that this was something new.
"Does the CIA know this?" Sandberg asked.
"No,"
Lowell said bluntly. He had never been afraid of the truth.
"We've been watching some accounts offshore, but nothing's happened. How much money?"
"A lot. I don't know how much, and I don't know how they found it."
"Where did it come from?"
"They don't know for sure, but they're desperate to link it to Joel Backman. They're talking to the White House."
"And not us?"
"Evidently not. It reeks of politics. They'd love to pin a scandal on President Morgan, and Backman would be the perfect conspirator."
"Duke Mongo would be a nice target, too."
"Yes, but he's practically dead. He's had a long, colorful career as a tax cheat, but now he's out to pasture. Backman has secrets. They want to haul him back, run him through the grinder over at Justice, blow the top off Washington for a few months. It will humiliate Morgan."
"The economy's sliding like hell. What a wonderful diversion."
"Like I said, it's all about politics."
Lowell finally took a bite of pizza and chewed it quickly as he thought.
"Can't be Backman. They're way off target."
"You're sure?"
"I'm positive. Backman had no idea a pardon was in the works. We literally yanked him out of his cell in the middle of the night, made him sign some papers, then shipped him out of the country before sunrise."
"And where did he go?"
"Hell, I don't know. And if I did, I wouldn't tell you. The point is that Backman had no time to arrange a bribe. He was buried so deep in prison, he couldn't even dream of a pardon. It was Teddy's idea, not his. Backman's not their man."
"They intend to find him."
"Why? He's a free man, fully pardoned, not some convict on the run. He can't be extradited, unless, of course, they squeeze an indictment."
"Which they can do."
Lowell frowned at the table for a second or two.
"I can't see an indictment. They have no proof. They have some suspicious money sitting in a bank, as you say, but they don't know where it came from. I assure you it's not Backman's money."
"Can they find him?"
"They're going to put the pressure on Teddy, and that's why I wanted to talk."
He shoved the half-eaten pizza aside and leaned in closer.
There will soon be a meeting in the Oval Office. Teddy will be there, and he'll be asked by the president to see the sensitive stuff on Backman. He will refuse. Then it's showdown time. Will the Prez have the guts to fire the old man?
Will he?
Probably. At least Teddy's expecting it. This is his fourth president, which, as you know, is a record. And the first three have all wanted to fire him. Now, though, he's old and ready to go.
He's been old and ready to go forever.
True, but he's run a tight ship. This time, it's different.
Why doesn't he just resign?
Because he's a cranky, contrary, stubborn old son of a bitch. You know that.
That's well established.
And if he gets fired, he's not going peacefully. He'd like balanced coverage.
Balanced coverage was their long-standing buzzword for slanted our way. Sandberg slid his pizza away, too, and cracked his knuckles.
Here's the story, as I see it, he said, part of the ritual. After 18 years of solid leadership at the CIA, Teddy Maynard gets sacked by a brand new president. The reason is that Maynard refused to divulge details of sensitive ongoing operations. He stood his ground to protect national security and stared down the president, who, along with the FBI, wants classified information so that it, the FBI, can pursue an investigation relating to pardons granted by former President Morgan.
You cannot mention Backman.
I'm not ready to use names. I don't have confirmation.
I assure you the money did not come from Backman. And if you use his name at this point, there's a chance he'll see it and do something stupid.
Like what?
Like run for his life.
Why is that stupid?
Because we don't want him running for his life.
You want him dead?
Of course. That's the plan. We want to see who kills him.
Sandberg settled back against the hard plastic bench and looked away. Lowell picked slices of pepperoni off his cold, rubbery pizza, and for a long time they thought in silence. Sandberg drained his Diet Coke and finally said,
Teddy somehow convinced Morgan to pardon Backman, who is stashed away somewhere as bait for the kill.
Lowell was looking away but nodding.
And the killing will answer some questions over at Langley?
Perhaps. That's the plan.
Does Backman know why he was pardoned?
We certainly haven't told him, but he's fairly bright.
Who's after him?
Some very dangerous people who carry grudges.
Do you know who?
A nod, a shrug, a non-answer.
There are several with potential. We'll watch closely and maybe learn something. Maybe not.
And why are they carrying grudges?
Lowell laughed at the ridiculous question.
Nice try, Dan. You've been asking that for 6 years now. Look, I gotta go. Work on the balanced piece and let me see it.
When is the meeting with the president?
Not sure. As soon as he gets back.
And if Teddy's terminated?
You'll be the first person I call.
As a small-town lawyer in Culpeper, Virginia, Neil Backman was earning far less than what he had dreamed about in law school. Back then, his father's firm was such a force in D.C. that he could easily see himself making the big bucks after only a few years of practice. The greenest associates at Backman, Pratt & Bowling started at $100,000 a year, and a rising junior partner, 30 years of age, would earn three times as much. During his second year of law school, a local magazine put the broker on the cover and talked about his expensive toys. His income was estimated at $10 million a year. This had caused quite a stir around law school, something Neil was not uncomfortable with. He could remember thinking how wonderful the future would be with all that earning potential. However, less than a year after signing on as a Green associate, he was sacked by the firm after his father pled guilty and was literally thrown out of the building. But Neil had soon stopped dreaming of the big money and the glitzy lifestyle. He was perfectly content to practice law with a nice little firm on Main Street and hopefully take home $50,000 a year. Lisa stopped working when their daughter was born. She managed the finances and kept their lives on budget. After a sleepless night, he awoke with a rough idea of how to proceed. The most painful issue had been whether or not to tell his wife. Once he decided not to, the plan began to take shape. He went to the office at 8 as usual and puttered online for an hour and a half until he was sure the bank was open. As he walked down Main Street, he found it impossible to believe that there might be people lurking nearby watching his movements. Still, he would take no chances. Richard Coley ran the nearest branch of Piedmont National Bank. They went to church together, hunted grouse, played softball for the Rotary Club. Neil's law firm had banked there forever. The lobby was empty at such an early hour, and Richard was already at his desk with a tall cup of coffee, the Wall Street Journal, and evidently very little to do. He was pleasantly surprised to see Neil, and for 20 minutes they talked about college basketball. When they eventually got around to business, Richard said, "So, what can I do for you?" "Just curious," Neil said casually, delivering lines he had been rehearsing all morning. "How much might I borrow with just my signature?" "Bit of a jam, huh?" Richard was grabbing the mouse and already glancing at the monitor, where all answers were stored. "No, nothing like that. Rates are so low and I've got my eye on a hot stock." "Not a bad strategy, really. Though I certainly can't advertise it. With the Dow at 10,000 again, you wonder why more folks don't load up with credit and buy stocks." "It would certainly be good for the old bank." He managed an awkward banker's chuckle at his own quick humor. "Income range?" he asked, tapping keys, somber-faced now. "It varies," Neil said. 60 to 80. Richard frowned even more, and Neil couldn't tell if it was because he was sad to learn his friend made so little or because his friend earned so much more than he. He'd never know. Small-town banks were not known for overpaying their people. "Total debts outside the mortgage?" he asked, tapping again. "Let's see." Neil closed his eyes and ran through the math again. His mortgage was almost $200,000, and Piedmont held that. Lisa was so opposed to debt that their own little balance sheet was remarkably clean. "Car loan of about $20,000, he said. "Maybe $1,000 or so on the credit cards. Not much, really." Richard nodded his approval and never took his eyes off the monitor. When his fingers left the keyboard, he shrugged and turned into the generous banker. "We could do $3,000 on a signature, 6% interest for 12 months. Since he'd never borrowed with no collateral, Neil wasn't sure what to expect. He had no idea what his signature would command, but somehow $3,000 sounded about right. "Can you go $4,000? He asked. Another frown, another hard study of the monitor. Then it revealed the answer. "Sure, why not? I know where to find you, don't I?" "Good. I'll keep you posted on the stock. Is this a hot tip, something on the inside? Give me a month. If the price goes up, I'll come back and brag a little." "Fair enough." Richard was opening a drawer, looking for forms. Neil said, "Look, Richard, this is just between us boys, okay? Know what I mean? Lisa won't be signing the papers." "No problem," the banker said, the epitome of discretion. "My wife doesn't know half of what I do on the financial end. Women just don't understand." "You got it. And along those lines, would it be possible to get the funds in cash?" A pause, a puzzled look. But then anything was possible at Piedmont National. "Sure. Give me an hour or so. I need to run to the office and sue a guy, okay? I'll be back around noon to sign everything and get the money." Neil hustled to his office 2 blocks away with a nervous pain in his stomach. Lisa would kill him if she found out, and in a small town, secrets were hard to bury. In 4 years of a very happy marriage, they had made all decisions together. Explaining the loan would be painful, though she would probably come around if he told the truth. Repaying the money would pose a challenge. His father had always been one to make easy promises. Sometimes he came through, sometimes he didn't, and he was never too concerned one way or the other. But that was the old Joel Backman. The new one was a desperate man with no friends, no one to trust. What the hell? It was only $4,000. Richard would keep it quiet. Neil would worry about the loan later. He was, after all, a lawyer. He could squeeze in some extra fees here and there, put in a few more hours. His primary concern at that moment was the package to be shipped to Rudolph Viscovich. With the cash bulging in his pocket, Neil fled Culpeper during the lunch hour and hurried up to Alexandria, 90 minutes away. He found the store Chatter in a small strip mall on Russell Road, a mile or so from the Potomac River. It advertised itself online as the place to go for the latest in telecom gadgetry and one of the few places in the United States where one could purchase unlocked cell phones that would work in Europe. As he browsed for a few moments, he was astounded at the selection of phones, pagers, computers, satellite phones, everything one could possibly need to keep in touch. He couldn't browse for long. There was a 4 o'clock deposition in his office. Lisa would be making one of her many daily check-ins to see what, if anything, was happening downtown. He asked a clerk to show him the Onkyo 850 PC Pocket smartphone, the greatest technological marvel to hit the market in the past 90 days. The clerk removed it from a display case and, with great enthusiasm, switched languages and described it as full QWERTY keyboard, tri-band operation on 5 continents, 80 megabyte built-in memory, high-speed data connectivity with EGPRS, wireless LAN access, Bluetooth wireless technology, IPv4 and IPv6 dual-stack support, infrared, POP port interface, Symbian operating system version 7.0S, Series 80 platform. Automatic switching between bands? Yes. Covered by European networks? Of course. The smartphone was slightly larger than the typical business phone, but it was comfortable in the hand. It had a smooth metallic surface with a rough plastic back cover that prevented sliding when in use. It's larger, the clerk was saying, but it's packed with goodies. Email, multimedia messaging, camera, video player, complete word processing, internet browsing, and complete wireless access almost anywhere in the world. Where are you going with it? Italy? It's ready to go. You'll just need to open an account with a service provider. Opening an account meant paperwork. Paperwork meant leaving a trail, something Neil was determined not to do. What about a prepaid SIM card, he asked. We got 'em. For Italy, it's called a TIM, Telecom Italia Mobile. It's the largest provider in Italy, covers about 95% of the country. I'll take it. Neil slid down the lower part of the cover to reveal a full keypad. The clerk explained, it's best to hold it with both hands and type with the thumbs. You can't fit all 10 fingers on the keypad. He took it from Neil and demonstrated the preferred method of thumb typing. Got it, Neil said. I'll take it. The price was $925 plus tax, plus another $89 for the TIM card. Neil paid in cash as he simultaneously declined the extended warranty, rebate registration, owner's program, anything that would create paperwork and leave a trail. The clerk asked for his name and address, and Neil declined. At one point, he said with great irritation, "Is it possible to simply pay for this and leave?" "Well, sure, I guess," the clerk said. "Then let's do it. I'm in a hurry." He left and drove half a mile to a large office supply store. He quickly found a Hewlett-Packard tablet PC with integrated wireless capability. Another $440 got invested in his father's security, though Neil would keep the laptop and hide it in his office. Using a map he had downloaded, he found the package post in another strip mall nearby. Inside at a shipping desk, he hurriedly wrote 2 pages of instructions for his father, then folded them into an envelope containing a letter and more instructions he'd prepared earlier that morning. When he was certain no one was watching, he wedged 20 $100 bills in the small black carrying case that came with the Onkyo Marvel. Then he placed the letter and the instructions, the smartphone, and the case inside a mailing carton from the store. He sealed it tightly, and on the outside he wrote with a black marker, "Please hold for Marco Lazzari." The carton was then placed inside another, slightly larger one, that was addressed to Rudolf Viscovich at Via Zamboni 22, Bologna. The return address was Package Post, 8851 Braddock Road, Alexandria, Virginia, 22302. Because he had no choice, he left his name, address, and phone number on the registry in case the package got returned. The clerk weighed the package and asked about insurance. Neil declined and prevented more paperwork. The clerk added the international stamps and finally said, "Total is $18.20. Neil paid him and was assured again that it would be mailed that afternoon. Chapter 19. In the semi-darkness of his small apartment, Marco went through his early morning routine with his usual efficiency. Except for prison, when he had little choice and no motivation to hit the ground running, he had never been one to linger after waking. There was too much to do, too much to see. He had often arrived at his office before 6 a.m., breathing fire and looking for the day's first brawl, and often after only 3 or 4 hours of sleep. Those habits were returning now. He wasn't attacking each day, wasn't looking for a fight, but there were other challenges. He showered in less than 3 minutes, another old habit that was aided mightily on Via Fondazza by a severe shortage of warm water. Over the lavatory, he shaved and worked carefully around the quite handsome growth he was cultivating on his face. The mustache was almost complete. The chin was solid gray. He looked nothing like Joel Backman, nor did he sound like him. He was training himself to speak much slower and in a softer voice. And of course, he was doing so in another language. His quick morning routine included a little espionage. Beside his bed was a chest of drawers where he kept his things. 4 drawers all the same size, with the last one 6 inches above the floor. He took a very thin strand of white thread he had unraveled from a bedsheet, the same thread he used every day. He licked both ends, leaving as much saliva as possible, then stuck one end under the bottom of the last drawer. The other end was stuck to the side brace of the chest, so that when the drawer was opened, the invisible thread was pulled out of position. Someone, Luigi he presumed, entered his room every day while he was studying with either Ermanno or Francesca, and went through the drawers. His desk was in the small living room under the only window. On it he kept an assortment of papers, notepads, books, Ermanno's Guide to Bologna, a few copies of the Herald Tribune, a sad collection of free shopping guides he had gathered from gypsies who passed them out on the streets, his well-used Italian-English dictionary, and the growing pile of study aids Ermanno was burdening him with. The desk was only moderately well-organized, a condition that irritated him. His old lawyer's desk, one that wouldn't fit in his current living room, had been famous for its meticulous order. A secretary fussed over it late every afternoon. But amid the rubble was an invisible scheme. The desk surface was some type of hardwood that had been nicked and marked over the decades. One defect was a small stain of some sort. Marco had decided it was probably ink. It was about the size of a small button and was located almost in the dead center of the desk. Every morning as he was leaving, he placed the corner of a sheet of scratch paper directly in the center of the ink stain. Not even the most diligent of spies would have noticed. And they didn't. Whoever sneaked in for the daily sweep had never, not once, been careful enough to place the papers and the books back in their precise location. Every day, 7 days a week, even on the weekends when he was not studying, Luigi and his gang entered and did their dirty work. Marco was considering a plan whereby he would wake up one Sunday morning with a massive headache, telephone Luigi, still the only person he talked to on the cell phone, and ask him to fetch some aspirin or whatever they used in Italy. He would go through the ruse of nursing himself, staying in bed, keeping the apartment dark until late in the afternoon when he would call Luigi again and announce he felt much better and needed something to eat. They would walk around the corner, have a quick bite, then Marco would suddenly feel like returning to his apartment. They would be gone for less than an hour. Would someone else handle the sweep? The plan was taking shape. Marco wanted to know who else was watching him. How large was the net? If their concern was simply to keep him alive, then why would they sift through his apartment every day? What were they afraid of? They were afraid he would disappear. And why should that frighten them so? He was a free man, perfectly free to move about. His disguise was good. His language skills were rudimentary but passable and improving daily. Why should they care if he simply drifted away, caught a train and toured the country, never came back? Wouldn't that make their lives easier? And why keep him on such a short leash with no passport and very little cash? They were afraid he would disappear. He turned off the lights and opened the door. It was still dark outside under the arcaded sidewalks of Via Fondazza. He locked the door behind him and hurried away, off in search of another early morning café. Through the thick wall, Luigi was awakened by a buzzer somewhere in the distance, the same buzzer that awakened him most mornings at such dreadful hours.
"What's that?"
she said.
"Nothing,"
he said as he flung the covers in her direction and stumbled naked out of the room. He hurried across the den to the kitchen where he unlocked the door, stepped inside, closed and locked it, and looked at the monitors on a folding table. Marco was leaving through his front door, as usual. And at 6:10, again, nothing unusual about that. It was a very frustrating habit. Damn Americans. He pushed a button and the monitor went silent. Procedures required him to get dressed immediately, hit the streets, find Marco, and watch him until Ermanno made contact. But Luigi was growing tired of procedures, and he had Simona waiting. She was barely 20, a student from Naples, an absolute doll he'd met a week earlier at a club he'd discovered. Last night had been their first together, and it would not be their last. She was already sleeping again when he returned and buried himself under the blankets. It was cold outside. He had Simona. Whitaker was in Milan, probably still asleep and probably in bed with an Italian woman. There was absolutely no one monitoring what he, Luigi, would do for the entire day. Marco was doing nothing but drinking coffee. He pulled Simona close and fell asleep. It was a clear, sunny day in early March. Marco finished a 2-hour session with Ermanno. As always, when the weather cooperated, they walked the streets of central Bologna and spoke nothing but Italian. The verb of the day had been fare, translated as to do or to make, and as far as Marco could tell, it was one of the most versatile and overused verbs in the entire language. The act of shopping was fare la spesa, translated as to make the expenses or to do the acquisitions. Asking a question was fare la domanda, to make a question. Having breakfast was fare la colazione, to do breakfast. Ermanno signed off a little early, again claiming he had studies of his own to pursue. More often than not, when a strolling lesson came to an end, Luigi made his appearance, taking the handoff from Ermanno, who vanished with remarkable speed. Marco suspected that such coordination was meant to give him the impression that he was always being watched. They shook hands and said goodbye in front of Feltrinelli's, one of the many bookstores in the university section. Luigi appeared from around the corner and offered the usual hearty, "Buongiorno." "Pranziamo?" "Are we having lunch?" "Certamente." The lunches were becoming less frequent, with Marco getting more chances to dine by himself and handle the menu and the service. "Ho trovato un nuovo ristorante." "I have found a new restaurant."
"Andiamo."
"Let's go." It wasn't clear what Luigi did with his time during the course of a day, but there was no doubt he spent hours scouring the city for different cafes, trattorias, and restaurants. They had never eaten at the same place twice. They walked through some narrow streets and came to Via dell'Indipendenza. Luigi did most of the talking, always in very slow, deliberate, precise Italian. He had forgotten English as far as Marco was concerned.
"Francesca can't study this afternoon," he said.
"Why not?"
"She has a tour. A group of Australians called her yesterday. Her business is very slow this time of year. Do you like her?
Am I supposed to like her?
Well, that would be nice.
She's not exactly warm and fuzzy.
Is she a good teacher?
Excellent. Her perfect English inspires me to study more.
She says you've studied very hard and that you are a nice man.
She likes me?
Yes, as a student.
Do you think she's pretty?
Most Italian women are pretty, including Francesca.
They turned onto a small street, Via Goito, and Luigi pointed just ahead.
Here, Luigi said,
and they stopped at the door to Franco Rossi's.
I've never been here, but I hear it's very good.
Franco himself greeted them with a smile and open arms. He wore a stylish dark suit that contrasted nicely with his thick gray hair. He took their coats and chatted with Luigi as if they were old friends. Luigi was dropping names and Franco was approving of them. A table near the front window was selected.
Our best one, Franco said with a gush.
Marco looked around and didn't see a bad table.
The antipasti here are superb,
Franco said modestly, as if he hated to brag about his food.
My favorite of the day, however, would be the sliced mushroom salad. Lino adds some truffles, some parmesan, a few sliced apples.
At that point, Franco's words faded as he kissed the tips of his fingers.
Really good, he managed to say with his eyes closed, dreaming.
They agreed on the salad, and Franco was off to welcome the next guests.
Who's Lino? Asked Marco.
His brother, the chef.
Luigi dipped some Tuscan bread in a bowl of olive oil. A waiter stopped by and asked about wine.
Certainly, Luigi said. I'd like something red from the region.
There was no question about it. The waiter stabbed his pen at the wine list and said,
This one here, Eliano from Imola. It's fantastic.
He took a whiff of the air just to emphasize the point. Luigi had no choice.
We'll try it.
We were talking about Francesca, Marco said. She seems so distracted. Is something wrong with her?
Luigi dipped some bread in the olive oil and chewed on a large bite while debating how much to tell Marco.
Her husband is not well, he said.
Does she have children?
I don't think so.
What's wrong with her husband?
He's very sick. I think he's older. I've never met him.
Il Signore Rossi was back to guide them through the menus, which wasn't really needed. He explained that the tortellini just happened to be the best in Bologna, and particularly superb that day. Lino would be happy to come out of the kitchen and verify this. After the tortellini, an excellent choice would be the veal filet with truffles. For more than 2 hours, they followed Franco's advice, and when they left, they pushed their stomachs back down Via dell'Indipendenza and discussed their siestas. He found her by accident at the Piazza Maggiore. He was having an espresso at an outdoor table, braving the chill in the bright sunshine, after a vigorous 30-minute walk, when he saw a small group of fair-haired seniors coming out of the Palazzo Comunale, the city's town hall. A familiar figure was leading, a thin, slightly built woman who held her shoulders high and straight, her dark hair falling out from under a burgundy beret. He left €1 on the table and headed toward them. At the Fountain of Neptune, he eased in behind the group, 10 in all, and listened to Francesca at work. She was explaining that the gigantic bronze image of the Roman god of the sea was sculpted by a Frenchman over a 3-year period from 1563 to 1566. It was commissioned by a bishop under an urban beautification program aimed at pleasing the Pope. Legend has it that before he began the actual work, the Frenchman was concerned about the ample nudity of the project. Neptune is stark naked, so he sent the design to the Pope in Rome for approval. The Pope wrote back, "For Bologna, it's okay." Francesca was a bit livelier with the real tourists than she was with Marco. Her voice had more energy, her smile came quicker. She was wearing a pair of very stylish eyeglasses that made her look 10 years younger. Hiding behind the Australians, he watched and listened for a long time without being noticed. She explained that the Fontana del Nettuno is now one of the most famous symbols of the city and perhaps the most popular backdrop for photos. Cameras were pulled from every pocket, and the tourists took their time posing in front of Neptune. At one point, Marco managed to move close enough to make eye contact with Francesca. When she saw him, she instinctively smiled, then said a soft, "Buongiorno."
"Buongiorno.
Mind if I tag along?" he asked in English.
"No. Sorry I had to cancel."
"No problem. How about dinner?" She glanced around as if she had done something wrong. "To study, of course, nothing more," he said.
"No, I'm sorry," she said.
She looked beyond him across the piazza to the Basilica di San Petronio.
"That little cafe over there," she said, "beside the church at the corner. Meet me there at 5, and we'll study for an hour."
"Va bene." The tour continued a few steps to the west wall of the Palazzo Comunale, where she stopped them in front of 3 large framed collections of black and white photos. The history lesson was that during World War II, the heart of the Italian resistance was in and around Bologna. The Bolognese hated Mussolini and his fascists and the German occupiers, and worked diligently in the underground. The Nazis retaliated with a vengeance. Their well-publicized rule was that they would murder 10 Italians for every 1 German soldier killed by the resistance. In a series of 55 massacres in and around Bologna, they murdered thousands of young Italian fighters. Their names and faces were on the wall, forever memorialized. It was a somber moment, and the elderly Australians inched closer to look at the heroes. Marco moved closer, too. He was struck by their youthfulness, by their promise that was forever lost, slaughtered for their bravery. As Francesca moved on with her group, he stayed behind, staring at the faces that covered much of the long wall. There were hundreds, maybe thousands of them. A pretty female face here and there, brothers, fathers and sons, an entire family. Peasants willing to die for their country and their beliefs. Loyal patriots with nothing to give but their lives. But not Marco. No, sir. When forced to choose between loyalty and money, Marco had done what he always did. He'd gone for the money. He had turned his back on his country, all for the glory of cash. She was standing inside the door of the cafe, waiting, not drinking anything, but of course, having a smoke. Marco had decided that her willingness to meet so late for a lesson was further evidence of her need for the work.
"Do you feel like walking?" she said before she said hello.
Of course. He had walked several miles with Ermanno before lunch, then for hours after lunch waiting on her. He'd walked enough for one day, but then what else was there to do? After a month of doing several miles a day, he was in shape.
"Where?"
"It's a long one," she said. They wound through narrow streets heading to the southwest, chatting slowly in Italian, discussing the morning's lesson with Ermanno. She talked about the Australians, always an easy and amiable group. Near the edge of the old city, they approached the Porta Saragozza, and Marco realized where he was and where he was going. "Up to San Luca?" he said.
"Yes. The weather is very clear. The night will be beautiful. Are you okay?"
His feet were killing him, but he would never think of declining. "Andiamo," he said. "Let's go." Sitting almost 1,000 feet above the city, on the Colle della Guardia, one of the first foothills of the Apennines, the Santuario di San Luca has for 8 centuries looked over Bologna as its protector and guardian. To get up to it without getting wet or sunburned, the Bolognese decided to do what they'd always done best, build a covered sidewalk. Beginning in 1674 and continuing without interruption for 65 years, they built arches, 666 arches, over a walkway that eventually runs for 3.6 kilometers, the longest porticoed sidewalk in the world. Though Marco had studied the history, the details were much more interesting when they came from Francesca. The hike up was a steady climb, and they paced themselves accordingly. After 100 arches, his calves were screaming for relief. She, on the other hand, glided along as if she could climb mountains. He kept waiting for all that cigarette smoking to slow her down. To finance such a grandiose and extravagant project, Bologna used its considerable wealth. In a rare display of unity among the feuding factions, each arch of the portico was funded by a different group of merchants, artisans, students, churches, and noble families. To record their achievement and to secure their immortality, they were allowed to hang plaques opposite their arches. Most had disappeared over time. Francesca stopped for a brief rest at the 170th arch, where one of the few remaining plaques still hung. It was known as La Madonna Grassa, the Fat Madonna. There were 15 chapels en route. They stopped again between the 8th and 9th chapels, where a bridge had been built to straddle a road. Long shadows were falling through the porticos as they trudged up the steepest part of the incline. "It's well lighted at night," she assured him, "for the trip down." Marco wasn't thinking about the trip down. He was still looking up, still gazing at the church, which at times seemed closer and at other times seemed to be sneaking away from them. His thighs were aching now, his steps growing heavier. When they reached the crest and stepped from under the 666th portico, the magnificent basilica spread before them. Its lights were coming on as darkness surrounded the hills above Bologna, and its dome glowed in shades of gold. "It's closed now," she said. "We'll have to see it another day." During the hike up, he had caught a glimpse of a bus easing down the hill. If he ever decided to visit San Luca again for the sole purpose of wandering through another cathedral, he'd be sure to take the bus. "This way," she said softly, beckoning him over. "I know a secret path." He followed her along a gravel trail behind the church to a ledge where they stopped and took in the city below them. "This is my favorite spot," she said, breathing deeply, as if trying to inhale the beauty of Bologna. "How often do you come here?"
"Several times a year, usually with groups. They always take the bus. Sometimes on a Sunday afternoon, I'll enjoy the walk up."
"By yourself?"
"Yes, by myself."
"Could we sit somewhere?"
"Yes, there is a small bench hidden over there. No one knows about it."
He followed her down a few steps, then along a rocky path to another ledge with views just as spectacular.
"Are your legs tired?"
she asked. "Of course not," he lied. She lit a cigarette and enjoyed it as few people could possibly enjoy one. They sat in silence for a long time, both resting, both thinking and gazing at the shimmering lights of Bologna. Marco finally spoke. "Luigi tells me your husband is very ill."
"I'm sorry."
She glanced at him with a look of surprise, then turned away.
"Luigi told me the personal stuff is off limits."
"Luigi changes the rules. What has he told you about me?"
"I haven't asked. You're from Canada, traveling around trying to learn Italian."
"Do you believe that?"
"Not really."
"Why not?"
"Because you claim to have a wife and a family, yet you leave them for a long trip to Italy. And if you're just a businessman off on a pleasure trip, then where does Luigi fit in? And Ermanno? Why do you need those people?"
"Good questions. I have no wife."
"So it's all a lie?"
"Yes."
"What's the truth?"
"I can't tell you."
"Good, I don't want to know."
"You have enough problems, don't you, Francesca?"
"My problems are my business."
She lit another cigarette. "Can I have one of those?" he asked.
"You smoke?"
"Many years ago." He picked one from the pack and lit it. The lights from the city grew brighter as the night engulfed them. "Do you tell Luigi everything we do?" he asked.
"I tell him very little."
"Good." Chapter 20. Teddy's last visit to the White House was scheduled for 10 a.m. He planned to be late. Beginning at 7 that morning, he met with his unofficial transition team, all four deputy directors and his senior people. In quiet little conferences, he informed those he had trusted for many years that he was on the way out, that it had been inevitable for a long time, that the agency was in good shape,
and life would go on. Those who knew him well sensed an air of relief. He was, after all, pushing 80, and his legendary bad health was actually getting worse. At precisely 8:45, while meeting with William Lucat, his deputy director for operations, he summoned Julia Javier for their Bachman meeting. The Bachman case was important, but in the scheme of global intelligence, it was mid-list. How odd that an operation dealing with a disgraced former lobbyist would be Teddy's downfall. Julia Javier sat next to the ever-vigilant Hobie, who was still taking notes that no one would ever see, and began matter-of-factly.
He's in place, still in Bologna. So if we had to activate now, we could do so.
I thought the plan was to move him to a village in the countryside, some place where we could watch him more closely, Teddy said.
That's a few months down the road.
We don't have a few months.
Teddy turned to Lucat and said,
What happens if we push the button now?
It'll work. They'll get him somewhere in Bologna. It's a nice city with almost no crime. Murders are unheard of, so his death will get some attention if his body is found there. The Italians will quickly realize that he's not, what's his name, Julia?
Marco,
Teddy said without looking at notes.
Marco Lazzari.
Right. They'll scratch their heads and wonder who the hell he is.
Julia said, There's no clue as to his real identity. They'll have a body, a fake ID, but no family, no friends, no address, no job, nothing. They'll bury him like a pauper and keep the file open for a year. Then they'll close it.
That's not our problem, Teddy said. We're not doing the killing.
Right, said Lucat. It'll be a bit messier in the city, but the boy likes to wander the streets. They'll get him. Maybe a car will hit him. The Italians drive like hell, you know.
It won't be that difficult, will it?
I wouldn't think so.
And what are our chances of knowing when it happens? Teddy asked.
Lucat scratched his beard and looked across the table at Julia, who was biting a nail and looking over at Hobie, who was stirring green tea with a plastic stick. Lucat finally said,
I'd say 50-50, at the scene anyway. We'll be watching 24-7, but the people who'll take him out will be the best of the best. There may be no witnesses.
Julia added, Our best chance will be later, a few weeks after they bury the pauper. We have good people in place. We'll listen closely. I think we'll hear it later.
Lucat said, As always, when we're not pulling the trigger, there's a chance we won't know for sure.
We cannot screw this up, understand? It'll be nice to know that Bachman is dead. God knows he deserves it. But the goal of the operation is to see who kills him.
Teddy said, as his white, wrinkled hands slowly lifted a paper cup of green tea to his mouth. He slurped it loudly, crudely. Maybe it was time for the old man to fade away in a retirement home.
I'm reasonably confident, Lucat said.
Hobie wrote that down.
If we leak it now, how long before he's dead?
Teddy asked. Lucat shrugged and looked away as he pondered the question. Julia was chewing another nail. It depends, she said cautiously. If the Israelis move, it could happen in a week. The Chinese are usually slower. The Saudis will probably hire a freelance agent. It could take a month to get one on the ground.
The Russians could do it in a week, Lucat added.
I won't be here when it happens, Teddy said sadly. And no one on this side of the Atlantic will ever know. Promise me you'll give me a call.
This is the green light? Lucat asked.
Yes. Careful how you leak it, though. All hunters must be given an equal chance at the prey.
They gave Teddy their final farewells and left his office. At 9:30, Hobie pushed him into the hall and to the elevator. They rode down 8 levels to the basement, where the bulletproof white vans were waiting for his last trip to the White House. The meeting was brief. Dan Sandberg was sitting at his desk at the Post when it began in the Oval Office a few minutes after 10, and he hadn't moved 20 minutes later when the call came from Rusty Lowell.
It's over, he said.
What happened? Sandberg asked, already pecking at his keyboard.
As scripted, the president wanted to know about Bachman. Teddy wouldn't budge. The president said he was entitled to know everything. Teddy agreed, but said the information was going to be abused for political purposes and it would compromise a sensitive operation. They argued briefly. Teddy got himself fired, just like I told you.
Wow.
The White House is making an announcement in 5 minutes. You might want to watch.
As always, the spin began immediately. The somber-faced press secretary announced that the president had decided to pursue a fresher course with our intelligence operations. He praised Director Maynard for his legendary leadership and seemed downright saddened by the prospect of having to find his successor. The first question, shot from the front row, was whether Maynard resigned or had been fired. The president and Director Maynard reached a mutual understanding.
What does that mean?
Just what I said.
And so it went for 30 minutes. Sandberg's front-page story the following morning dropped two bombs. It began with the definite confirmation that Maynard had been fired after he refused to divulge sensitive information for what he deemed to be raw political purposes. There was no resignation, no reaching of a mutual understanding. It was an old-fashioned sacking. The second blast announced to the world that the president's insistence on obtaining intelligence data was directly tied to a new FBI investigation into the selling of pardons. The cash for pardon scandal had been a distant rumbling until Sandberg opened the door. His scoop practically stopped traffic on the Arlington Memorial Bridge. While Sandberg was hanging around the press room, reveling in his coup, his cell phone rang. It was Rusty Lowell, who abruptly said,
"Call me on a landline and do it quickly."
Sandberg went to a small office for privacy and dialed Lowell's number at Langley.
"Lucat just got fired," Lowell said. "At 8 o'clock this morning, he met with the president in the Oval Office. He was asked to step in as the interim director. He said yes. They met for an hour. The president pushed on Backman. Lucat wouldn't budge. Got himself fired, just like Teddy."
"Damn, he's been there 100 years.
38, to be exact. One of the best men here. A great administrator."
"Who's next?"
"That's a very good question. We're all afraid of the knock on the door."
"Somebody's got to run the agency."
"Ever meet Susan Penn?"
"No, I know who she is, but I never met her."
"Deputy Director for Science and Technology. Very loyal to Teddy. Hell, we all are. But she's also a survivor. She's in the Oval Office right now. If she's offered the interim, she'll take it. And she'll give up Backman to get it."
"He is the president, Rusty. He's entitled to know everything."
"Of course. And it's a matter of principle. Can't really blame the guy. He's new on the job, wants to flex his muscle. Looks like he'll fire us all until he gets what he wants. I told Susan Penn to take the job to stop the bleeding."
"So the FBI should know about Backman real soon."
"Today, I would guess. Not sure what they'll do when they find out where he is. They're weeks away from an indictment. They'll probably just screw up our operation."
"Where is he?"
"Don't know."
"Come on, Rusty. Things are different now."
"The answer is no. End of story. I'll keep you posted on the bloodletting."
An hour later, the White House press secretary met with the press and announced the appointment of Susan Penn as interim director of the CIA. He made much of the fact that she was the first female to hold the position, thus proving once again how determined this president was to labor diligently for the cause of equal rights. Luigi was sitting on the edge of his bed, fully dressed and all alone, waiting for the signal from next door. It came at 14 minutes after 6 a.m. Marco was becoming such a creature of habit. Luigi walked to his control room and pushed a button to silence the buzzer that indicated that his friend had exited through the front door. A computer recorded the exact time, and within seconds, someone at Langley would know that Marco Lazzari had just left their safe house on Via Fondazza at precisely 6:14. He hadn't trailed him in a few days. Simona had been sleeping over. He waited a few seconds, slipped out his rear door, cut through a narrow alley, then peeked through the shadows of the arcades along Via Fondazza. Marco was to his left, headed south, and walking at his usual brisk pace, which was getting faster the longer he stayed in Bologna. He was at least 20 years older than Luigi, but with his penchant for walking miles every day, he was in better shape. Plus, he didn't smoke, didn't drink much, didn't seem to be interested in ladies and the nightlife, and he had spent the last 6 years in a cage. Little wonder he could roam the streets for hours, doing nothing. He wore the new hiking boots every day. Luigi had not been able to get his hands on them. They remained bug-free, leaving no signal behind. Whitaker worried about this in Milan, but then he worried about everything. Luigi was convinced that Marco might walk for 100 miles within the city, but he wasn't leaving town. He'd disappear for a while, go exploring or sightseeing, but he could always be found. He turned onto Via Santo Stefano, a main avenue that ran from the southeast corner of Old Bologna into the thick of things around Piazza Maggiore. Luigi crossed over and followed from the other side. As he practically jogged along, he quickly radioed Zelman, a new guy in town, sent by Whitaker to tighten the web. Zelman was waiting on Strada Maggiore, another busy avenue between the safe house and the university. Zelman's arrival was an indication of the plan moving forward. Luigi knew most of the details now and was somewhat saddened by the fact that Marco's days were numbered. He wasn't sure who would take him out, and he got the impression that Whitaker didn't know either. Luigi was praying that he would not be called upon to do the deed. He had killed 2 other men and preferred to avoid such messes. Plus, he liked Marco. Before Zelman picked up the trail, Marco vanished. Luigi stopped and listened. He ducked into the darkness of a doorway just in case Marco had stopped too. He heard him back there, walking a little too heavily, breathing a little too hard. A quick left on a narrow street, Via Castellata, a sprint for 50 yards, then another left onto Via de Chiari, and a complete change of direction from due north to due west, a hard pace for a long time until he came to an opening, a small square called Piazza Cavour. He knew the old city so well now, the avenues, alleys, dead ends, intersections, the endless maze of crooked little streets, the names of every square and many of the shops and stores. He knew which tobacco stores opened at 6 and which waited until 7. He could find 5 coffee shops that were filled by sunrise, though most waited until daylight. He knew where to sit in the front window behind a newspaper with a view of the sidewalk and wait for Luigi to stroll by. He could lose Luigi anytime he wanted, though most days he played along and kept his trails wide and easy to follow. But it was the fact that he was being watched so closely that spoke volumes. "They don't want me to disappear," he kept saying to himself. "And why?" "Because I'm here for a reason." He swung wide to the west of the city, far away from where he might be expected to be. After almost an hour of zigzagging through and looping around dozens of short streets and alleys, he stepped onto Via Irnerio and watched the foot traffic. Bar Fontana was directly across the street. There was no one watching it. Rudolph was tucked away in the rear, head buried low in the morning paper, pipe smoke rising in a lazy blue spiral. They hadn't seen each other in 10 days, and after the usual warm greetings, his first question was,
"Did you make it to Venice?"
"Yes, a delightful visit." Marco dropped the names of all the places he had memorized from the guidebook. He raved about the beauty of the canals, the amazing variety of bridges, the smothering hordes of tourists. A fabulous place. Couldn't wait to go back. Rudolph added some of his own memories. Marco described the Church of San Marco as if he'd spent a week there. "Where to next?" Rudolph inquired. "Probably south toward warmer weather. Maybe Sicily, the Amalfi Coast." Rudolph, of course, adored Sicily and described his visits there. After half an hour of travel talk, Marco finally got around to business. "I'm traveling so much, I really have no address. A friend from the States is sending me a package. I gave him your address at the law school. Hope you don't mind. Rudolf was relighting his pipe.
It's already here. Came yesterday,
he said with heavy smoke pouring out with the words. Marco's heart skipped a beat. Was there a return address?
Someplace in Virginia.
Good. His mouth was instantly dry. He took a sip of water and tried to conceal his excitement. Hope it wasn't a problem.
Not at all.
I'll swing by later and pick it up.
I'm in the office from 11 to 12:30.
Good, thanks. Another sip. Just curious, how big is the package? Rudolf chewed on the stem of his pipe and said, "A small cigar box, maybe." A cold rain started at mid-morning. Marco and Hermano were walking through the university area and found shelter in a quiet little bar. They finished the lesson early primarily because the student pushed so hard. Hermano was always ready to quit early. Since Luigi had not booked lunch, Marco was free to roam, presumably without being followed, but he was careful just the same. He did his loops and backtracking maneuvers and felt silly as always. Silly or not, they were now standard procedure. Back on Via Zamboni, he drifted behind a group of students strolling aimlessly along. At the door to the law school, he ducked inside, bounded up the stairs, and within seconds was knocking on Rudolph's half-opened door. Rudolph was at his ancient typewriter, hammering away at what appeared to be a personal letter.
"Over there,"
he said, pointing to a pile of rubble covering a table that hadn't been cleared in decades.
"That brown thing on top."
Marco picked up the package with as little interest as possible. "Thanks again, Rudolph," he said, but Rudolph was typing again and in no mood for a visit. He had clearly been interrupted.
"Don't mention it," he said over his shoulder, releasing another cloud of pipe smoke.
"Is there a restroom nearby?" Marco asked.
"Down the hall on your left."
"Thanks. See you around." There was a prehistoric urinal and three wooden stalls. Marco went into the far one, locked the door, lowered the lid, and took a seat. He carefully opened his package and unfolded the sheets of paper. The first one was plain, white, no letterhead of any kind. When he saw the words, "Dear Marco," he felt like crying. "Dear Marco, needless to say, I was thrilled to hear from you. I thanked God when you were released, and I pray for your safety now. As you know, I will do anything to help. Here is a smartphone, state-of-the-art and all that. The Europeans are ahead of us with cell phone and wireless internet technology, so this should work fine over there. I've written some instructions on another sheet of paper. I know this will sound like Greek, but it's really not that complicated. Don't try and call. It's too easy to track. Plus, you would have to use a name and set up an account. Email is the way. By using Quite Mail with encryption, it's impossible to track our messages. I suggest that you email only me. I can then handle the relays. On this end, I have a new laptop that I keep near me at all times. This will work, Marco. Trust me. As soon as you're online, email and we can chat. Good luck. Grinch. March 5th. Grinch? A code or something. He had not used their real names. Marco studied the sleek device, thoroughly bewildered by it, but also determined to get the damn thing going. He probed its small case, found the cash, and counted it slowly as if it were gold. The door opened and closed. Someone was using the urinal. Marco could hardly breathe. "Relax," he kept telling himself. The restroom door opened and closed again, and he was alone. The page of instructions was handwritten, obviously when Neil didn't have a lot of time. It read, "Ankyo 850 PC Pocket Smartphone, fully charged battery, 6 hours talk time before recharging, recharger included. Step 1. Find internet cafe with wireless access, list enclosed. Step 2. Either enter cafe or get within 200 feet of it. Step 3. Turn on. Switch is upper right-hand corner. Step 4. Watch screen for access area, then the question, access now?
Press Yes under screen. Wait. Step 5. Then push keypad switch bottom right and unfold keypad. Step 6. Press Wi-Fi access on screen. Step 7. Press Start for Internet browser. Step 8. At cursor type www.quitemail.com. Step 9. Type username Grinch456. Step 10. Type passphrase post hoc ergo propter hoc. Step 11. Press compose to begin new message form. Step 12. Select my email address, 123grinch@quitemail.com. Step 13. Type your message to me. Step 14. Click on Encrypt Message. Step 15. Click Send. Step 16. Bingo. I'll have the message. More notes followed on the other side, but Marco needed to pause. The smartphone was growing heavier by the minute as it inspired more questions than answers. For a man who had never been in an internet cafe, he could not begin to understand how one could be used from across the street or within 200 feet. Secretaries had always handled the email flood. He had been much too busy to sit in front of a monitor. There was an instruction booklet that he opened at random. He read a few lines and didn't understand a single phrase. "Trust Neil," he told himself. "You have no choice here, Marco. You have to master this damn thing." From a website called www.access.com, Neil had printed a list of free wireless internet places in Bologna. 3 cafes, 2 hotels, 1 library, and 1 bookstore. Marco folded his cash, stuck it in his pocket, then slowly put his package back together. He stood, flushed the toilet for some reason, and left the restroom. The phone, the papers, the case, and the small recharger were easily buried in the deep pockets of his parka. The rain had turned to snow when he left the law school, but the covered sidewalks protected him and the crowd of students hurrying to lunch. As he drifted away from the university area, he pondered ways to hide the wonderful little assets Neil had sent him. The phone would never leave his person, nor would the cash. But the paperwork, the letter, the instructions, the manual, where could he stash them? Nothing was protected in his apartment. He saw in a store window an attractive shoulder bag of some sort. He went and inquired. It was a Silvio brand laptop case, navy blue, waterproof, made of a synthetic fabric that the sales lady could not translate. It cost 60 euros, and Marco reluctantly placed them on the counter. As she finished the sale, he carefully placed the smartphone and its related items into the bag. Outside, he flung it over his shoulder and tucked it snugly under his right arm. The bag meant freedom for Marco Lazzari. He would guard it with his life. He found the bookstore on Via Ugo Bassi. The magazines were on the second level. He stood by the rack for 5 minutes, holding a soccer weekly while watching the front door for anyone suspicious. Silly, but it was a habit now. The internet hookups were on the third floor in a small coffee shop. He bought a pastry and a Coke and found a narrow booth where he could sit and watch everyone going and coming. No one could find him there. He pulled out his Onkyo 850 with as much confidence as he could muster and glanced through its manual. He reread Neil's instructions. He followed them nervously, typing on the tiny keypad with both thumbs the way it was illustrated in the owner's manual. After each step, he looked up to check the movements around the cafe. The steps worked perfectly. He was online in short order, much to his amazement, and when the codes worked, he was looking at a screen that was giving him the okay to write a message. Slowly, he moved his thumbs around and typed his first wireless internet email. "Grinch, got the package. You'll never know how much it means to me. Thank you for your help. Are you sure our messages are completely secure? If so, I will tell you more about my situation. I fear I am not safe. It's about 8:30 a.m. your time.
I'll send this message now and check back in a few hours. Love, Marco. He sent the message, turned the machine off, then stayed for an hour, poring over the manual. Before he left to meet Francesca, he turned it on again and followed the route to get online. On the screen, he tapped Google Search, then typed in Washington Post. Sandberg's story caught his attention, and he scrolled through it. He had never met Teddy Maynard, but they had spoken several times by phone. Very tense conversations. The man had been practically dead 10 years ago. In his other life, Joel had butted heads a few times with the CIA, usually over shenanigans his defense contractor clients were trying to pull. Outside the bookstore, Marco sized up the street, saw nothing of interest, and began another long walk. Cash for pardons? What a sensational story. But it was asking too much to believe that an outgoing president would take bribes like that. During his spectacular fall from power, Joel had read many things about himself, about half of them true. He had learned the hard way to believe little of what got printed.